From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To The Point.
First the inferno, now the cleanup. What then? Hello again, I'm Aaron Olney, and this is To The Point. The blazes in Northern California are being called firestorms, hurricanes, and blizzards of flame. They've been compared to a blowtorch. In a state where wildfires are hardly uncommon, experts say civilian casualties and property loss are historic like nothing they've ever seen. Survivors are warned that debris is too toxic to allow digging for beloved possessions. Smoke and ashes are causing health problems for miles around. What caused the fires? Why did they spread? Can the next ones be prevented? Later on today's Talking Point, cutting back on university research is a ticking time bomb for America's economy and its lead in science and technology. First, here's the news.
Check out KCRW's all-news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, BBC, and more, 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24 or listen on KCRW's app.
Support for To The Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warman Olney, back with To The Point. Wildfire is all too familiar in the Golden State, but last week's record-setting blazes in Northern California left behind something new. More property damage over a wider area with more civilian casualties than ever before. We heard about likely causes, the struggle to clean up, and the possibility of prevention. Today's Talking Point, starting before the Trump administration, federal support for basic research at public universities has been on the decline. Scientists of the caliber to win Nobel Prizes are going someplace else. We'll hear how America is falling behind. First, his news update. Former President George W. Bush has hardly been heard from for 10 years. But today in New York, he delivered a scathing speech about the current state of American politics.
Bigotry seems emboldened. Our politics seems more vulnerable to conspiracy theories and outright fabrication. Bigotry or white supremacy in any form is blasphemy against the American creed.
In Politico today, Edward Isaac Devere calls that an unmistakable denunciation of Trumpism without mentioning the president by name. Good to have you on our program.
Hi, Warren. How are you?
Very well. What was the occasion for this speech?
Well, this was an event that was held by the Bush Institute. It was called the Spirit of Liberty Conference. They brought together a bipartisan group of people, including a panel that had on it President Trump's ambassador to the UN, Nikki Haley, former Secretary of State for Bill Clinton, Madeleine Albright, and former George W. Bush Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice. And it was about talking about what democracy is, both at home and abroad. And the program was finished with this speech that was about 15, 16 minutes long by the former president, which was pretty clearly a statement about American politics today and about the president, President Trump, and what is happening right now through him in American politics.
One thing he said is, we know that when we lose sight of our ideals, it's not democracy that has failed. It is the failure of those charged with preserving and protecting democracy. That's highly charged because it's part of the presidential oath to preserve and protect democracy.
That's right. And this goes to statements that President Obama has made that have been more directly taking on President Trump. But as you pointed out in your introduction, President Bush has almost completely taken himself out of the political fray since leaving office. He campaigned for his brother Jeb Bush a little bit when Jeb Bush was running for the Republican nomination in 2016. But President George W. Bush has been someone who has looked at his time in office as a set period and then the post-presidency as a different thing where he would mostly move to retirement. He's obviously done a lot with painting and some speeches around the world, but not public speeches like this, not political speeches like this, as a regular thing.
Here's another passage from today's address by the former president.
We've seen nationalism distorted into nativism. We've forgotten the dynamism that immigration has always brought to America. We see a fading confidence in the value of free markets and international trade, forgetting that conflict, instability, and poverty follow in the wake of protectionism. We've seen the return of isolationist sentiments, forgetting that American security is directly threatened by the chaos and despair of distant places.
Back to Isaac DeVere with Politico. So we got immigration, we've got free markets, we've got national security, all issues that President Trump has been criticized for.
Yeah, and you'd have to be delirious to not think that President Bush is talking about President Bush.
President
speech,
Trump.
Although, sorry, the President Bush is not speaking about President Trump in this speech. Yes, because he's hitting on all the issues, all the things that President Trump has been most associated with politically, as well as some of the personal stuff. President Bush also spoke about bullying and cruelty and coarseness and all of those being problems in American politics right now. President Bush may not be part of the political conversation, before today may not have been, but he has certainly been paying attention to it. He is someone who is very attuned to what's going on in politics and gets a lot of briefings and conversations going on around him all the time that are part of what is happening in this country. And it seems like he felt like today was a point when he wanted to uncork some of this.
And, of course, he stayed away from the inauguration, even though he, too, is a Republican. Oh, I'm sorry. Did he go to the inauguration?
He was at the inauguration, and there was a report that has not been knocked down that after President Trump's inaugural address, President Bush said that was some crazy, and I'll let your listeners fill in the blanks.
Okay.
But that was some crazy blank.
All right. Some weird stuff. And once again, the president of the United States doesn't want to be quoted using that word. Edward Isaac DeVere, it's always good to talk with you. And thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Chief Washington correspondent for Politico. In a moment, first the inferno, then the cleanup. What now? This is To the Point from PRI.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. Some of the wildfires in California's wine and cannabis country moved 14 miles in 2 hours last week, lighting the sky as they blazed through the night. The death toll is at least 42. Some 3,000 homes were destroyed. 213 acres have been turned into charred wastelands. Nick Rahm has lived through it all. He is a resident of Santa Rosa, and he is reporting about it for the city's Press Democrat, where he works. Nick, good to have you on our program.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Just tell us, if you will, a little bit about what it was like when this first happened and how you yourself experienced it.
Well, I actually live just south of Santa Rosa in Petaluma, but I did wake up in the middle of the night smelling smoke. But there were some people in the newsroom who were evacuated, and the fire ripped quickly through the mountains northeast of Santa Rosa, down through some more affluent areas in the mountains around the city, into residential neighborhoods, completely wiping them out. There was some emergency notice, but it was pretty chaotic. Many people got out, many people evacuated by having their neighbors alert them. It was neighbors alerting neighbors, scrambling to leave for safety.
What is the situation now? We've heard a lot about the concern about whether there were enough warnings and so on. But what, as people go back into their homes now, or what's left of their homes, is going on? How would you describe the situation?
In terms of the firefights, they've definitely turned a corner. All Sonoma County and Sonoma County fires are 80% contained. this past, there was estimates of more than 60,000 people who were forced to evacuate their homes. And in the past 3 days, more than 42,000 have been allowed back. Many of those still have their homes standing. With electricity out, they had some cleanup in the refrigerator, but the places that were destroyed by the fire, the real areas of destruction, those would be restricted. Residents would be restricted from those areas for a few more days to another week.
Tell us about Coffee Park. That's a subdivision in Santa Rosa.
Yeah, Coffee Park is a, say, middle-income subdivision. It's to the west of Highway 101, so I don't think any residents there ever thought that a wildfire could threaten their neighborhood. Many homeowners, some elderly people, and many renters, too. And the fire jumped the highway, say, about 2 in the morning, and just leveled homes. The whole area is looks like a bomb went off. There's more than 1,000 homes there. I'm still assessing the damage of exactly how many homes in that neighborhood were destroyed. Miraculously, there were a few homes standing undestroyed and areas completely wiped out. And so there's a lot of cleanup that's going to happen before residents are let in those areas. And some residents have been getting frustrated with roadblocks, road closures, wanting to see what's left of their homes, afraid of looting in areas that were restricted where homes are still standing. But authorities say the number one priority right now is to get people back into their homes.
Why did the firefighters say it was so difficult to get in to those areas and to get the residents out?
I think it's all about time. The fire was moving so quickly, and most people don't have or use landlines anymore, so they use Nixel. They did do an emergency call, a reverse 911, although that's a brand name, they use something different, to target homes in the areas threatened by the fire. Some people received those calls. Other people did not. They also sent out Nixel notifications, which is an online message system that people can sign up for notifications from local law enforcement and public safety agencies. But getting the word out in such a short period of time was a great difficulty. And that's still being assessed, what went right, what went wrong, how they could have done things better. But there was an option to use a wireless emergency alert, similar to an Amber Alert that's managed by FEMA. And Sonoma County Emergency Management chose not to use that because it would send an alert to every phone pinging a cell tower in Sonoma County. And they didn't want to cause panic and chaos and clog the roadways from the northern end of the county to the southern end.
All right, Nick Graham, again, a reporter with the Press Democrat. Again, that's in Santa Rosa County. Santa Rosa, the city of Santa Rosa. Karen Relucio is a director of the Public Health Issues in Public Health Department in Napa County. Good to have you on our program. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, good morning.
I understand that one of the concerns you have, and there was plenty of fire in the Napa Valley as well as over in Santa Rosa, one valley away. You're concerned about people going through the rubble and not being careful enough about it. What's the concern?
So when a structure burns down, just imagine all of the chemicals in your house. You have household cleaners, gasoline, propane tanks, pesticides that all melt along with the plastics and the paint on the walls. So you have substances such as cadmium, lead, mercury, arsenic, asbestos, and polycyclic hydrocarbons, which all have negative impacts on human health. They can cause acute injury, and they can also cause long-term chronic health effects.
So how likely is somebody who digs through their house in one of these areas we've seen where everything is just absolutely flattened, how likely are they to be affected, and should they be wearing special clothing?
Yes. So the way to prevent exposures is to wear personal protective equipment such as N95 respirators, goggles, thick gloves, pants with a long long pants and a long sleeve shirt, along with construction boots. And there are a few reasons why. One is to diminish exposure to the chemicals that are in the ash. Number two, there could be sharp debris in the ash, so people can get cuts and puncture wounds. And number three, is there are sometimes areas of the ash that is still hot, so there may be some ash pits and other areas that are dangerous.
Can you shovel it up? Or can you use a backhoe to move it?
No. We strongly recommend that you leave it to the experts that know how to clean up this debris. So using a backhoe will dig some of the toxins deeper into the dirt. If it is not disposed right, it could affect drinking water supplies or rivers and streams. It could be aerosolized and go into other areas that are not affected by that debris. It could aerosolize the ash. The other issue is we don't want to dig that stuff further into the ground. So it has to be done right. Also, not all landfills can accept that kind of debris. There are specialized landfills that can do that.
You're head of public health in Napa, in the Napa County. To what extent is there assistance from FEMA and from state agencies and other agencies as well?
So our environmental health and our planning and building departments are working with state and federal agencies, including Cal OES, in conjunction with FEMA, to work on a cleanup process that is done correctly and can protect human health. So this is in the process right now, and we are not going to be the only county that's affected by this. Other counties that have experienced wildfires are also doing the same thing.
Let me go back to Nick Raham again. He's in Santa Rosa. Do you notice, Nick, that people are, in fact, being careful in the way that Karen Relucio, who's in charge of public health over in Napa, suggests?
Well, people right now aren't allowed back to their homes that were destroyed. People who are being allowed back into neighborhoods that have been deemed safe by local law enforcement and firefighters. So I don't think those precautions are being taken by most allowed back into the evacuated zones. On Monday, about 12 hours after the fire, there wasn't enough support from other agencies to come in to close the roads. Some residents who evacuated were milling through their stuff, just wearing sneakers, T-shirts, and most of them have masks. So in the immediate aftermath of the fire, those who did make their way back to their homes, there was very little precaution taken.
So, Karen Relucio, that's what you're worried about. Sneakers and T-shirts aren't going to do it.
That's correct. And we've seen pictures in the media of people going through their debris without that type of protection. And we're hoping that we can prevent people that are going to go back to their properties in the future to protect themselves. So that's exactly the concern that I'm seeing that.
Wind obviously was very important in the fires. It's also been very important, as I understand it, in distributing the toxic ash, not just in that area, but with the smoke going as far as the San Francisco Bay area. How concerned are you about that?
So air quality is something that we're keeping an eye on several times a day. It actually helps. I mean, there are people that are at risk of wildfire smoke, and this includes children, seniors, and people with underlying respiratory conditions that can actually have worsening symptoms as a result of smoke exposure. So there are varying on the Bay Area Air Quality Management District website, there is a table that looks at the varying levels of air quality and the impacts or the risks on human health, depending on risk factors. So we do keep an eye on that, and that has helped. We've had to make decisions on whether we can reopen school because of air quality. And unfortunately, air quality changes throughout the day. It depends on the prevailing winds. It depends on how much is burning. And it changes. It almost changes by, like every few hours, the quality changes. So it becomes hard to make that prediction of what the impact will be.
Karen
Malusio, changes like the weather.
Karen Malusio, once again, Director of Public Health in Napa County. Stephen Pine is a professor in the School of Life Science at Arizona State University. He's also a fire historian. He's author of a lot of books on the subject, including Tending Fire, Coping with America's Wildland Fires. Welcome to you. Good to have you.
My pleasure.
Have you ever heard of anything like what's happening in Northern California, or what's happened and is now continuing to happen in Northern California?
Yeah. Historically, we've actually, believe it or not, had far worse fires, order of magnitude worse fires, historically. But what we haven't seen this kind of severity for probably a century. I mean, the problem, this kind of fire problem was identified as a national issue 30 years ago, and people have been working on it. But we've seen a steady ramping up of the casualties, if you will. And this seems to be, we may have reached an inflection point, that this may be the time and the fire that really triggers a kind of serious response. The loss of life, we haven't seen this, civilian casualties from a fire like this for a century. Property, I think most of us would have thought the Oakland 91 fire was probably the upper limit of what could possibly happen out of this. And the fires in Santa Rosa are doubling that destruction. So the whole overall severity is really a stunner to have it come back. It's like watching some plague that we thought we had solved. Now suddenly it's mutated, it's reappeared, and it's become threatening. The fire community likes to talk in triangles. So my second point would be, I think, the collateral damages that Karen just talked about. Smoke has been an issue even before the Northern California fires. It's been striking to track. We're getting smoke maps. It's on the radar. And for a long time, it's just considered a third world problem in Southeast Asia, for example, with their haze, or something that rural communities like Missoula have to put up with as a seasonal nuisance. But this year is beginning with the fires and smoke from D.C. We've been smoking in Seattle, Portland, now San Francisco. That really changes the calculus, and it puts smoke as a collateral part of fires as another threat to public health and safety. And the other issue is the toxicity that Karen described. You know, in wildlands, fires break down the biomass, they liberate all this stuff, put it out in the environment. We celebrate that. That's what part of what keeps the ecosystem functioning. It's a good recycling. But much of what we build now in our environments where we live, we don't want that stuff loose. We want it contained. We want it channeled when it's disposed of, and the fire is liberating all of that. So I think we have to expand our sense of what these fires are doing now to include all these collateral issues.
Okay, let me just interrupt you for a moment, because Karen Relucio is only going to be with us for another couple of minutes. And you're a doctor, as I understand it, Dr. Relucio. A little bit more, if you will, about some of the health hazards involved here.
And so the materials that are in, the ash are mixed. There are a bunch of heavy metals, the polycyclic hydrocarbons, and other, among other things. And so some of the things that we look at is, respiratory disease. We can have neurologic damage. It could be in the peripheral nerves or in the brain. There's increased risk of cancer associated with some of the materials that are in ash and debris. So these are not... these can be severe issues.
All right. Karen Relucio, Dr. Karen Relucio, Director of Public Health in Napa. Thanks so much for being with us. We're going to take a very brief break on our talking point. We'll talk about cutting back university research, a ticking time bomb for America's economy and its lead in science and technology. Back with this conversation in a moment on To the Point from PRI. Warren Olney back with To the Point, talking today about the fires in Northern California. Nick Graham of the Santa Rosa Press Democrat still with us. So is Stephen Pine of Arizona State University. Said we haven't seen anything quite like this for 100 years in this country. Scott Stevens is a professor of fire science and at UC Berkeley. He's co-director of the UC Centers for Forestry and Fire, and he grew up in Napa. Good to have you on our program.
Happy to be here.
Have you ever seen anything like this?
No, I haven't either. I was actually here also for the 91 Oakland Hills fire that Steve mentioned, and that was a traumatic event, to say the least. But it was one area, you know, and it was awful and just terrible in terms of lives lost. But this one, with so many fires burning simultaneously in one general period, is something that I haven't seen. We've seen this with lightning fires in California. In June 2008, we had something on the order of 200, 300, 400 lightning fires ignited within 24-hour period. But this is in much more remote country. A lot of them basically are managed for resource benefits, sometimes put out, but nothing like this actually in an urban area.
Well, we just heard there's smoke in a lot of other places as well. What's going on? Is there some general issue? Is it climate change? Is there something else that has changed?
Well, climate change has changed fire in terms of maybe really 2 points we know. One is actually increased temperatures. We know temperatures are up. Temperature up simply means we're going to have fuel moisture that's going to be reduced, both live moisture in plants that are living and also dead fuel moisture and dead and down woody materials. We also know fire season is increased in length, so we have more time for fires to ignite and run. These fires, certainly the northeast winds were just huge, you know, in terms of sustained velocities and also relative humidity, 15% or less. I don't think we could connect this directly to climate change, but one thing is kind of amazing. You know, just 10 months ago, we had these huge floods in California. We had the American River, we had the Napa River, the Russian River, all at flood stage. So 10 months later, now we got these fires almost in the same region causing this havoc. And I think climate change does say we expect to have more extreme events.
Are we failing to learn how to live in the environment where we are?
I'd say generally, yes. I think a place like California with a Mediterranean climate burns every year, and it's going to burn really forever because of just this nature. So if that's the backdrop, then the question becomes, how do you actually do a little better with living with fire? How do you make communities a little more resistant? And even the social side, I think there's a lot of work we could do here to actually enable people to know more about the threat, actually talk about it amongst themselves, actually talk about what things they might do. They have a neighbor in a wheelchair that actually is going to need some help. Maybe there's someone down the street that doesn't drive anymore because they're a senior citizen. So that maybe enables a community, when a fire inevitably happens, they could actually help to get these people out of harm's way. You can't do that when the fire is on top of you.
So I understand that the average age of people who died in these fires is well over 60. Does that suggest that they particularly, elderly people particularly, ought to be concerned?
I think it's true. I do. I think that just the ability to move, the ability, a lot of folks just don't have transportation. You know, you're in rural communities, or Santa Rosa is not a rural community. It's a fairly large, small town. But, you know, if you don't have a car, you can't drive, or maybe you're immobile, you're definitely more at risk when a fire like this happens.
Let me go back to Nick Graham, if I may, with the Santa Rosa Press-Democrat. Somebody told me recently, and I don't know if this is true or not, that Santa Rosa has become the fifth largest city in the state. Is that right?
No, fifth largest city in the Bay Area.
In the Bay Area. Okay,
yeah,
that makes better sense.
170,000 people.
Okay, that's still a lot of people. I want to go back to Stephen Payne at the University of Arizona. Let me ask you a question that is raised by Mike Davis, who is a well-known writer in Southern California. And he says this: we continue to send urban sprawl into our fire-dependent ecosystems with the expectation that firefighters will risk their lives to defend each new McMansion, and an insurance system that spreads costs across all homeowners will promptly replace whatever is lost. Is that a good analysis of what's going on?
Well, it's a good partial analysis. I would expand that to say that it's the sum of the ways we live on the land. And California has all the ingredients, as Scott explained very eloquently, for fires yearly, annually, and it has them in exaggerated forms. You're always going to have explosive big fires. On the other side, you've got one implacable force. Against that, we have continued to push development, cities, particularly in the form of urban sprawl, against that. And the distance between them is shortening. And, you know, there's not the old kind of rural buffer zones that were available. We just don't have, there's just not much to disentangle that. But the responses that we've made, particularly in California over a century, but not only in California, we define the issue continually as one of public safety. Well, that's the immediate response, of course. And so we want to build up firefighting, evacuation capabilities, you know, responsive rehabilitation of the homes and so forth as quickly as possible. But that only continues the cycle. It's not getting at the fundamentals. And we need to sort of begin disentangling these two mixed landscapes and define the problem a little differently. Yes, of course, it's public safety, but responding with more suppression, efforts like that, only it's like putting down a riot in a city. It's not a way to govern the landscape. So we need to do both.
So, Scott Stevens at UC Berkeley, you talked about having people know about the threat, understand it better, talk among themselves, discuss who might be the most vulnerable if, in fact, something like this occurs. What else can be done? And is it possible to prevent these fires?
I actually don't think it's possible to fully prevent them, as Steve said. You know, it is a fire environment here and also in a lot of places, the American Southwest, you know, the Pacific Northwest. So we're in a fire environment. So in some ways, I think you change the conversation that actually says, okay, we're in a fire environment. We actually now need to do as best we can to live here and also manage risk, understand risk, communicate risk, and really kind of have that frank, open conversation. I think there's so many communities in California, Northern California in particular, where I'm more familiar, that are much more vulnerable to fire than people perceive. So that's a conversation that needs to happen, and then maybe we can begin to think about building better or actually doing better with things like, you know, retrofitting houses and such so we can make a difference. We'll never take the risk to zero, but we can do better.
Let's talk, before we get back to the issue of what to do next, about the cause. Nick Ram is still with us again with the Press Democrat in Santa Rosa. What is being said so far about how these fires might have begun?
About it's still unknown, still being investigated. There's a lawsuit in San Francisco right now. A couple who lost their home is suing PG&E, saying that their power lines caused a fire.
PG&E, the Pacific Gas and Electric Company.
Yes, yes. And CAL FIRE folks, people with CAL FIRE aren't commenting on that. They're saying they're still investigating the fire. There were 11 fires burning in Sonoma and Napa counties at one point. The current Nuns Fire was five different fires that burned together around the Sonoma Valley. And so there's rumors and speculation, but CAL FIRE is staying tight-lipped about the cause.
So, again, it could have been the knocking down of fire lines. I'm interested, Scott Stevens, back to you at UC Berkeley, about what has been done in Australia, where I gather these kinds of issues exist, and yet there has been a very concerted effort to try to cope.
Yeah, they have had a little different paradigm, you know, and it has evolved because of climate change, but for many decades, they had this idea of prepare, stay, defend, or leave early. So the idea would be when you'd have a homeowner prepare their property, do it in earnest to try to reduce vulnerability from embers and sparks coming in. And then the idea would be you could actually then potentially get trained to actually stay in your home and actually take a firefighting effort at the home scale or a small neighborhood, defend your house. Or you choose to leave early. Maybe you want nothing to do with that because of a lot of reasons, and maybe you're an elderly person and young person, you want to get out. But since, you know, the 2000s, Australia's experienced really changes in climate, particularly higher temperatures. They have a four fire index down there that was made by a guy named MacArthur in the 60s. In theory, it was supposed to be a maximum of 100 value on the worst day. And they've been getting days maybe in the 80s sometimes of the index. But then February 2009, I think the index goes to 131, and they have one of the worst fires in their history. And unfortunately, I think 174 people die. So they actually do have another catastrophic level now where they actually ask people to actually evacuate and not defend their property. So, but one thing it does is I think it does a better job of getting the people that live in the interface in conversations of the interface, just like we talked about. They're much more, you know, aware maybe of some of the issues. Not everybody participates, but that's where we can be in California. You know, we have evacuations and we have, you know, rebuilding, just like Steve said. But the question becomes, you know, how do we ever feel like we're moving forward?
Let me go back to Stephen Pine at the University of Arizona. They say, or you've all said, that infrastructure isn't necessarily the best way to deal with this. But what if you buried the power lines? Couldn't the PG&E, the Pacific Gas and Electric Company, do that? It would be very expensive, but the wires wouldn't fall down and those big tubs on the top of the towers wouldn't explode.
Well, that's a great point. We don't know that if power lines caused it or not. And I understand the reluctance because the lawsuits, if it did, are going to be horrific and they're going to go on forever. But it sure has the look of an electrical storm. That was my impression. And it may be that it was a built electrical storm because of the power grid. These power line fires have become a growing threat. Bastrop County in Texas, Gatlinburg, Tennessee, a contributor. they're all over now, and we've got to rethink that. And we've been talking for years about the need to rebuild our creaky electrical grid nationally. Maybe this would be the time to fold some fire mitigation into that. There may be places where you want to bury it. There may be places where you want to be able to shut it off without shutting off all power to a city, get some software, redirect things, distribute the grid better. There are hundreds of things we could probably do, part of a national network, but we could make fire part of that project.
So, Scott Stevens, presumably it would be a lot cheaper for the PG&E and other electrical utilities to do that than it would to pay off a lot of lawsuits.
Well, unfortunately, that's true. You know, in Southern California has had some really big lawsuits, too, for ignitions from infrastructure as well. So it is. It is a problem, and I think it'd be interesting to actually think about infrastructure and maybe trying to find some of the areas that may be the most vulnerable, the most apt to maybe start fires and actually do something in a rebuilding phase.
As we talk about preparing houses, it's my understanding that in some cases the houses just sort of spontaneously combust. They just blow up because of the heat. Scott Stevens, is that right? And if so, when you leave the house, should you leave the windows open? Is there some way of coping with that?
Well, fires really can move into houses, but they really move by really both convection and hot gases transferring heat or radiation. Radiation is simply the heat off of a flame. And then the other thing is they have these sparks that move forward, you know, almost like raindrops that are just penetrating on houses when you have the sparks being put downwind. So one of those functions is going to start a house fire. Most cases in urban interface fires, we have the embers getting to small cracks, getting into a vent, getting into the attic, and starting fires. Very small, and then they get larger. So it really doesn't spontaneously burst into flame. It actually is a mechanism primarily from spot fires, maybe in the Coffee Park neighborhood, unfortunately. The houses were close enough together there could be radiation heat transfer and house-to-house transfer after the sparks got in there, because initially that was definitely started by spot fires or embers into the Coffee Park.
Stephen Pine, you're in Arizona. We've talked a lot about California. You mentioned, however, there have been fires and smoke being noticed in a lot of places. Is it just regional? Is it national? How widespread is this issue?
Well, it's all over. Some parts of the country are not naturally disposed to fire in a significant way. A lot of New England, for example, you don't have a wet, dry cycling of climates. It's all over. The issue of houses burning as part of this sort of rural or wildland complex is going national. For a long time, this problem was defined as a California pathology, just a quirky thing that happened out there. And it's all over the West. Now it's moving east. We're seeing Gatlinburg burn. We're seeing East Texas towns burn. We're seeing Oklahoma City. We're seeing others. And many of the worst problems are in the east from a design problem. What we're seeing, though, is instead of just having the houses go to the fires seem to be going where the houses are. And that may be part of the climate change dynamic as well. So at that point, it is no longer a California or even a regional problem. This becomes a national problem, and that might get some traction. At the same time, California has an oversized ability to influence the national fire policy. And if it were to come up with a kind of positive virtue cycle here of redefining the problem, that would have national consequences.
As we talk about the widespread nature of this problem, we have a lot of listeners around the country. I want to go back to Nick Rayum in Santa Rosa, dealing directly with what we are talking about. Are they still looking for bodies? 42 was the casualty number last time I heard it, but is it likely to go up?
It's likely to go up. There are, as of yesterday, there were 50 people unaccounted for. There were about more than 2,000 missing persons reports, but in the chaos of the evacuations, there people were located. But there are 50 who are unaccounted for, and there are cadaver dogs from Alameda County helping with the search and rescue operation. There are about 200 search and rescue volunteers who, at this point, are sifting through the ashes. The Sonoma County Sheriff did say some people may not be or cremated, and they may not be able to be identified because there's nothing left. They've identified some people with hip replacements, the number on that. So the process is ongoing, and the search and rescue effort will likely
cause or would likely have findings to make the death toll go up.
So, Stephen Pine, if the problem is moving east, as you say, and it might even be worse there because of the structures that are involved, are we going to be begin telling this story from that part of the world as well as from California, Washington State, Oregon, Montana, and places where we've heard it before?
Yeah, well, we already are. Certainly Florida, as people have moved from the coast of Florida into the interior, that has been happening. And it seems to be moving up the coastal plain, getting into the southern Appalachians. Who knows how far it will go? I was recently back from a research trip in Pennsylvania, and they have, on paper, the worst interface problem in the country. They just haven't had the fires to drive those. But that may be changing in the years to come.
All right. Well, hopefully they can think about it in the way that Scott Stephens suggests and try to cope with it in advance. I want to thank you all for being with us. Stephen Pine, again, professor at the School of Life Sciences, Arizona State University, fire historian, author of Tending Fire, Coping with America's Wildland Fires. Scott Stephens, professor of fire science, co-director of the UC Centers for Forestry and Fire. He's at UC Berkeley. Nick Raham with the Santa Rosa Press Democrat and man who has reported on and lived through all of this, and our earlier guest, Dr. Karen Lucio, Director of Public Health in Napa County. Great to have you all. In a moment, America's decline in support for basic research and the consequences for the future. On To the Point from Public Radio International. Warren Ollie here with today's talking point. Since the Great Recession and the start of the Obama administration, the federal government has been cutting back on basic research grants to public universities. In the Midwest especially, that's bad for the economy. Internationally, it's a decline of American leadership, especially compared to China. That's according to John Marcus. He's higher education editor at the Hechinger Report, and he's written about it recently in The Atlantic magazine. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You start your story at Ohio State, so let's begin there in the Midwest. Why is a particularly acute problem there?
Well, there are a lot of reasons for that. One is that I should just qualify one thing that you mentioned in the intro. We haven't actually cut federal R&D, but it has not kept up with the rate of inflation. Federal research and development spending has increased by about 8% since 2008 and 4% in the Midwest. But inflation has been 14% in the aggregate during that period of time. So we're falling behind. And that is compounded in the Midwest by the fact that state governments have disinvested from their public higher education institutions. And unlike on the coasts in places like Silicon Valley or the Route 128 corridor near Boston or the Research Triangle in North Carolina, these places, these public research universities are aren't surrounded by lots of other private universities. They're basically it. They're basically the economic driver when you're talking about research in these states.
How important are they to the development of science and technology?
Well, you know, we have a knowledge economy in this country that we take for granted, but we also have a very short attention span. And unfortunately, translating basic science into products takes a long time. And when we begin to see, we haven't yet seen the impact of this relative decline in spending on research, but we will over time. And as you also mentioned, China has also already surpassed us in the number of biotechnology patents that happened last year. And within the next few years, will surpass us in the proportion of spending on research and development relative to GDP. And that's an extraordinary development. The United States was the uncontested leader in this, and that is one of the reasons that we have such a robust economy, and we're squandering it.
You said now inflation's 14%. National spending on research is just gone up by 8%. In the Midwest, it's only 4%. Why is it less there?
Well, you know, there are a lot of reasons for this that has to do with the type of research being done. Some kinds of research cost more than other kinds of research. But that's a really excellent question for which I'm not sure anyone has an answer as to why those numbers are lower. But the compounded impact of the decline in federal spending, the disengagement in the disinvestment in public higher education by state governments in some states, and other issues such as there are also going on simultaneously to this, a huge decline in enrollment in the Midwest and the Northeast, which also affects revenues for higher education institutions. All of these have already had an impact in one very important way. There is a ranking of universities based on research and development spending, and most of the major public research universities in the Midwest have been falling down that ranking by a lot. So the University of Wisconsin, which was always in the top five, fell out of the top five. Other universities in the Midwest have fallen out of the top ranks of universities in terms of research and development spending. The other thing that they don't have that private universities and better-funded public research universities do is the resources to make up for these budget cuts in terms of providing lab support and to hire marquee faculty. So the major universities in the Midwest collectively have about $11 billion in endowment money. Harvard University alone has somewhere in the neighborhood of near $40 billion. Yeah. So Harvard has a big bag of money to reach into. These other universities are pretty tightly stretched.
Are qualified scientists who might win Nobel Prizes, walking away from these places?
There's certainly a lot of people who are trying to lure them away. The problem on top of everything else that they're facing is that these universities with their shorter and shorter resources year in year, year in and year out, are trying to provide counteroffers to faculty that are being recruited by wealthier universities, and with them goes their grant funding. Some of these universities have had some success at doing that, at keeping them, surprising amount of success. But some, the chancellor in particular at the University of Wisconsin is very straightforward about this. They're being poached, and so they have to take their very short budgets and try to stretch them to provide counteroffers, build new labs, hire new research assistants, and do the kinds of things it takes to keep these faculty from leaving.
You talked about state governments having issues. What about the federal budget, both under President Obama and under President Trump? Have research grants been declining from Washington?
Yes, they have. Federal research and development has been declining relative to inflation, and the Trump administration budget proposal would cut the principal federal research and development agencies by 11 to 18%. They would also cut an obscure but extremely important element of federal research funding called indirect costs. Every time a university gets a research grant, they also get another pile of money to pay for the overhead, the heat, the lights, the clerical help, the beakers, and the Trump administration proposes to eliminate that. Private universities with lots of money to buffer them from these kinds of things don't have to worry quite as much as public universities that really don't have any money left. Now, Congress has so far rebuffed these proposals. They actually added money to the National Science Foundation when they extended the budget in April, and they have so far stopped the Trump administration from eliminating indirect costs, at least for biomedical research. So it remains to be seen what happens with that.
Is the Obama administration to be free of criticism?
Spending on research and development was flat and actually fell relative to inflation during the Obama administration. There was some additional money pumped into research and development as part of the recovery money at the beginning of the recession, but that's all been spent. Some people who have read this story in The Atlantic that we're talking about have pointed out, well, it's not fair to compare 2008 till now because of that that money. But in fact, if you look since 2002, so even before the Obama administration, spending on research and development has been flat. We don't value the long-term benefits of this kind of research.
So what are we losing then? Now, people hear about beakers and lights and all that stuff and think, oh, it's a bunch of scientists in lab coats. But what do we all lose if we don't have this research being well supported?
Yeah, that is a problem. That is what people think about. And universities and colleges have no one to blame but themselves for a big part of not making the case for themselves, not making the argument about why this is important. Over time, we will begin to lose our edge in technological, our technological lead in the world economy. That's the long-term impact. Young scientists are leaving. They're being recruited by companies in Asia and by universities abroad. Very smart international students aren't coming here now for a lot of reasons, including the Trump travel ban and other reasons. International graduate study is down. So all of those things portend some basis for concern over the long term in our economic leadership in these fields.
So we lose our edge. Once again, that means economic leadership. How does it affect individuals?
Fewer jobs, less economic diversification. Many of these Midwest universities that we talked about at the outset are in areas where there is a need to diversify. You have mineral extraction or mining in a lot of these states, which is in the decline. And in places like Iowa, for example, which is principally agricultural, some of the fastest growing industries include alternative energy, which requires not only smart people to execute it, but research and development support, and they don't have it.
All right, John Marcus, once again, higher education editor at the Hechinger Report, also published recently on this subject in The Atlantic, a piece about American divestment in university research. Thanks a lot for being on our program.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'm Armin Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.